You're listening to the Sex and Psychology Podcast, the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Lehmiller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. If you start scrolling through Instagram or TikTok, it's only a matter of time before you'll come across some anti-masturbation content. You're likely to hear that masturbation is bad for your health, that it's addictive, and that you should just say no to self-pleasure. Case in point, I just saw this bonkers video of a self-proclaimed expert who has more than 1 million followers and who claims that ejaculation completely saps your body of testosterone, and that if you want to live a long and healthy life, you shouldn't do it more than once every 30 days. I'm sorry, but that's just fucking stupid. So we need to have a talk about the science of masturbation. In today's show, we're going to delve into what the science says about popular claims regarding the health benefits of semen retention, whether abstaining from masturbation actually boosts your testosterone, whether you can really become addicted to masturbating or to your vibrator, and so much more. I am joined once again by Dr. Eric Sprankle, an associate professor of clinical psychology and the co-director of the Sexuality Studies Program at Minnesota State University, Mankato. He's also a licensed clinical psychologist and ASEX-certified sex therapist affiliated with the Minnesota Sexual Health Institute. His latest book is titled DIY, The Wonderfully Weird History and Science of Masturbation. This is going to be another fun and fascinating conversation. Stick around, and we're going to jump in right after the break. As a sexuality researcher, my work requires me to search for a lot of, let's say, intimate content online. For example, if someone describes a fantasy to me and I want to better understand whether other people also have that fantasy and how it might play out for them, I'm going to search for it. And boy, is my browser history interesting. But I don't need my internet service provider to know everything I'm searching for all of the time and to track it. And unfortunately, they know everything that we do online. This episode's sponsor is a little different from usual, but if you have similar concerns to me, this is something you need. And more than 30 million people have signed up for this service. Check out Private Internet Access VPN. If you want to stop internet service providers from always looking over your shoulder and profiting off of your data, you need Private Internet Access, the world's most transparent VPN provider. They let you stay private online by hiding your IP address and encrypting your internet connection. It's easy to use, there are apps for all of the operating systems, and one subscription provides protection for unlimited devices at the same time. I've been looking for something like this for a long time, and I'm so glad I found Private Internet Access. I love how easy it is to use. Literally, all it takes is just one click, and I love the peace of mind it provides. As a public figure, I like to keep my private life private, and this tool allows me to do just that. So if you want to enjoy all of the benefits of Private Internet Access, now's the time to subscribe. Head over to piavpn.com/sexandpsychology and get an 83% discount. Seriously, 83%. That's just $2.03 a month, and you also get 4 extra months completely free. But you must go to piavpn.com/sexandpsychology for a truly private digital life. Once again, that's piavpn.com/sexandpsychology. Okay, Eric, let's talk about the science of masturbation. Now, I want to start by talking about this idea of semen retention, which has a long history and seems increasingly popular today. But before we dive into what the research says, let's talk about kind of where this fear of semen retention comes from. So in my textbook, The Psychology of Human Sexuality, I talk a little bit about something called DHAT syndrome, spelled D-H-A-T, I think I'm pronouncing that right, which is a fear of losing semen. And it's often described as this culture-bound phenomenon that's relatively prominent in India and Pakistan, where semen is kind of seen as this essential fluid and losing it is kind of like draining your life force. Now, as it turns out, this idea is not so culture-bound after all, and it's growing in popularity in the West. And I can't help but notice that in recent years, there's been this growing almost fetishization in the West with East Asian traditions in general when it comes to health and wellness. And that seems to include importing beliefs about semen retention. So tell us a little bit about how spiritually enlightened social media influencers have brought this idea of semen retention to the masses.
Yeah, I think you really explained it really well. It is a lot of white Western, like spiritual wellness influencers that you see on TikTok or Instagram, and they just kind of have a cherry picking of appropriation of various cultures outside of their own that kind of fit into their own wellness packages, right? And so a lot of that does come from Eastern traditions of like traditional Chinese medicine, parts of like Hinduism, and Taoism is a big one as it pertains to this. And they kind of pick out these little parts that deal with looking at semen as being kind of this vital fluid in your body or a vital force in your body. And therefore, any expulsion of this fluid, loss of this fluid is detrimental to your health. And so they can dismiss a lot of other health advice from Taoism, but they kind of latch on to this one. And I think they latch on to it in a very similar way that we were talking about previously, of that there's the general masturbation taboo and anxiety and insecurity about it. So, of course, anything speaking from a place of authority, especially the coveted like ancient traditions, you know, from a white Western perspective of viewing Eastern philosophies as kind of mystical and in their own right, that, oh, this must be true. Right. And I forget the logical fallacy that that's called, maybe something appeal to tradition or something that, mm-hmm. It's been around for thousands of years. It must be true. So you hear that argument a lot. And so it is an appropriation of Taoism and using traditional Chinese medicine for their own kind of white Western wellness kind of grift that they have going. And yeah, you definitely see that they are incorporating the semen as a vital fluid in your body that's completely connected to your physical health as being a strong component of whatever they're selling with their yoga classes or spiritual retreats or whatever. And that's the funny thing in terms of like being called names on social media. That was the new one I got during the course of the researching for this book, is that somebody called me an imperialist because I was, quote, shitting on Eastern philosophies or traditions. And of course, the person who called me an imperialist was some white guy from Seattle with tribal tattoos.
Of course.
So yeah. So you kind of understand like where this stuff is coming from. But yeah, they are definitely taking it from different philosophies and applying it for themselves. But what you were saying with the DOTS syndrome, yeah, it's a cultural bound syndrome. That's how I learned it. I'm a clinical psychologist. I got the DSM over my shoulders here, and that's how it's listed in there. That's how I learned about it early on in grad school. But throughout the course of researching this book, it's not so culture bound. The underlying fear is a fear of semen loss. It may look different in different cultures. I think within Pakistan and India, it focuses a lot of the fear that you're urinating out semen accidentally. But the underlying fear is still that you're losing semen, and that's harmful to your body in some way. And that's what we see in Europe and in the United States currently.
Yeah, it's so many things I could say here. But, you know, we've often heard about people being, you know, cafeteria Christians or cafeteria, right, whatever their religious background or tradition is, and just pulling out the bits and pieces that make sense to them. And we see a lot of people doing that with some of these East Asian cultures and traditions, just pulling out the parts that they believe in or want to support and so forth, and discarding the rest that's inconvenient to them. Right. So
right.
Yeah, this kind of thing happens a lot. But I think it is part of this sort of broader health and wellness trend, and part of like the all natural kind of like, if it comes from your own body, it's good for you. And so, you know, you need to retain that or whatever. And so there's, yeah, a lot of different ways to kind of unpack what's going on here. But what does the science of semen retention actually tell us? I mean, so what are the claimed benefits of abstaining from ejaculation for prolonged periods of time? And does the science say there's any actual benefits to that?
Right. Short answer is no. The science is completely different than what the claims from the semen retentionists are making. So what they are claiming, the benefits of not ejaculating, so retaining your semen, is that by retaining, you're not losing the vital nutrients that are in seminal fluid. And so they're worried about zinc loss. They're worried about protein loss, different sugars. They're worried about a decrease in testosterone and how that can affect muscle mass and everything else. And so a side note here, we may or may not get into this during this conversation, but so much of this is packaged in male insecurity and masculine insecurity of what it means to have like an idealized masculine body. And so masturbation really challenges those ideals, or at least they can make the argument that it challenges those ideals. And one way is that masturbation supposedly causes testosterone loss and muscle mass loss. And that always got me thinking of like, do they actually think like the testosterone is sitting in your epididymis and you're ejaculating out? Like, how is the loss actually occurring? So what the science actually says behind all of this is it's like a partial truth. It's like, yeah, semen does have a lot of nutrients in it. There's proteins, there's sugars, there's minerals in it. What is misunderstood, however, is the function of those vital nutrients in semen. The function of those nutrients is to support the life of the sperm cells, not the person making the sperm cells. Mm-hmm. It's such a trivial amount. It's just to make sure that the sperm cell is healthy, alive, mobile. It can get to point A and to point B, what it needs to do, if we're talking conception. Otherwise, your body doesn't care that you have semen sitting in it. If you're not ejaculating, it's just sitting in your prostate and seminal vesicles. Your body will slowly absorb it, and your body is not gaining any benefit from the trace amounts, even from that reabsorption. And from the testosterone, I have no idea where that's coming from, because that's circulating through your blood. Obviously, it's made in the testicles, but you're not ejaculating it out. They always like to point to this one study that shows 7 days of abstinence showed an increase in testosterone compared to those who were not abstinent. One thing to note here is that it didn't single out masturbation. This is any kind of abstinence. And that's the thing too, with any kind of NOFAP or semen retention claims, is that masturbation is not unique here. You're actually talking about abstaining from an orgasm, any mechanism to get it to an orgasm, but oftentimes they just kind of think that masturbation orgasm is the harmful one. An orgasm with your spouse on your wedding night to make a child, that's okay for your body. Your body doesn't care how it's having an orgasm. But what's interesting with that testosterone study is that it was retracted, so we can't even look at it for useful information. From some of the studies I was looking at in like fertility journals, there's a lot of debate over how long somebody should abstain from any kind of orgasm, again, just not for masturbation, to have a better increased chance or a likelihood of conceiving. And that was really just at a couple of days, like 48 hours. And really that's going to increase seminal volume. But even if you're abstaining for like 2 months with the goal of having like better fertility, that's actually not giving you better fertility. You're having greater volume of semen that's ejaculated, but the actual sperm cells themselves may not be healthier. And actually, there's an argument that more frequent ejaculations are healthier for fertility because you are kind of ejaculating out the duds in the stockpile. And so their argument that it even has any type of impact on testosterone or fertility is just not backed up by the data.
Yeah, it's so interesting that some people buy into this idea that ejaculate is just pure testosterone. And I mean, if you're right, so concerned about like not having enough testosterone in your body, I mean, shouldn't you be over at the glory hole or something? I mean, you can have this free supply of like endless pure testosterone, right?
Right, but right, absolutely.
That's not where they go for some reason.
No, I think that would challenge their views of idealized masculinity too. So I think that's more the issue.
Yeah, and speaking of masculinity, it's so interesting that these online communities that have emerged in the last decade or so who are preaching this masturbatory abstinence, they seem to suggest that abstinence is somehow going to give you these sexual superpowers. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this growing number of men, many of whom might identify as incels, who want to have sexual and romantic relationships, but they can't find partners. Mm-hmm. And then there are these communities telling them that you can't possibly be an attractive partner unless you give up masturbation. It's like you can't be hot, manly, and confident unless you're abstaining from self-pleasure and you're saving your orgasms for a partner, because supposedly the partnered sex orgasms are healthy, but the masturbatory orgasms aren't. Like, I don't know. I just can't deal with some of it.
Yeah, it's wild. It does stem from living a life that's not going as planned. That's kind of like how I'm viewing it, of like, okay, so they don't have the body that they want. And they may not have the body that they want because they're comparing themselves to this idealized kind of cultural beauty of like ripped muscles. They need to be in a Marvel movie or something, have that kind of like training and fitness routine. So they're not as shredded as they would like to be. They're not as wealthy as they'd like to be. They don't have a girlfriend, because typically these are straight younger guys who I'm seeing in these forums. And then they get across this information. It's like, oh, well, why am I not having the life that I want? And then masturbation falls into that. It's like, well, because you're wasting your potential by sitting in front of your computer jerking off. And that's not what real men do. Real men go out and hunt, they seek, they work and earn their orgasm. And they're a big thing on like earning an orgasm. Mm. And by just sitting at home masturbating to porn, that's an unearned, undeserved orgasm. And it's actually making yourself more lazy and less motivated to get out and go to the gym and find a partner yourself. And so why masturbation? Why did that fit again? Masturbation, anxiety, insecurity, we're already kind of on the fence whether this is healthy or not. And so someone telling us it's not healthy and this is why your life isn't going as great as you thought it would go. And also, I think more importantly, it's something completely within your control. And so, you know, you can't change your genetics. You can't change the job that you have in terms of like immediate earning potential or the gyms that you belong to or anything. But there is this one thing that you can do that's entirely in your control that if you just stop doing that, that would put you on the path to greatness. And so that's an easy buy-in, I think, for these young guys, and because they want to look better, be different. And it's just an easy buy-in that, oh, if I don't touch my genitals, that seems easy enough. And but what we know is that that's not easy enough. And that's where it can start getting into actually kind of dark territory. I know Dr. Nicole Prowse has been looking at this more recently, actually after I finished the writing of my book. So her stuff isn't included in as much as I would like to have been now. But looking at guys who are on these NoFap forums and are really beating themselves up because they relapsed. They masturbated and when they told themselves that they were on a weak streak and then they gave in to temptation. And now they're depressed, they're anxious, some of them are even suicidal. Other guys in the NoFap forums or whatever types of forums are bullying them and kind of chastising them for relapsing, and which is just making their depression, anxiety, even suicidality even worse. And so it's just like this self-torturous kind of lifestyle where it doesn't have to be this way at all. Just have to change the attitudes of like, masturbation is fine. It's normal. It's healthy. It's not going to hurt you. And if you do it, therefore, you're not going to feel distressed by it. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy both ways.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. And, you know, when you think about how a lot of these men are, they're really desperate because they mm-hmm. want to have these sexual and romantic connections. They can't seem to find them for whatever mm-hmm. reason. And so, you know, anybody who's willing to try and sell them on something that is going to help them get what they want, like people are willing to try almost anything when there's mm-hmm. something that they really want. And you're right that this is something that is within your control in terms of whether or not you do it. But many people, if not most people, find it really hard to have complete abstinence from masturbation, right? It's just right. a natural human tendency. It's a thing that people tend to do. And mm-hmm. so then when you can't do it, and then that kind of sets you up for failure, and then you start blaming yourself, and then it becomes, yeah, this really bad place, and people can spiral into, yeah, some really dark territory there.
Yeah, definitely a shame cycle. And it's like setting yourself up for failure. Like I would argue if anybody came to me, like I don't practice therapy, I'm a licensed psychologist, but I don't see patients. But if I was in practice and someone came to me with the goal of complete masturbatory abstinence, I wouldn't accept that at face value without question. I would definitely want to understand like, where is this coming from? Do you think this is a realistic goal for you? What do you expect to happen as a result of the abstinence? But for these guys on these forums coming with into like any type of self-help improvement kind of program with the goal of completely abstaining from masturbation is celebrated. And I think that's just setting you up for failure and setting you up for this shame cycle. And I think it's a part too of like this kind of biohacking thing that I'm not too familiar with it. I just kind of see it existing, like the Huperman lab kind of stuff of like all of, if you get up at 4 a.m. and take a cold shower and then run for 2 miles and make sure that you eat, right? And make sure you eat like 2 handfuls of like rolled oats and just all of this, like it's a to-do list. It's a ridiculous to-do list. But again, I think in terms of having control over something, this is something that you can do. It's not practical. It's certainly not sustainable. I would like to think that there's some goof out there that this is his grift, that he knows this doesn't work, but just likes to torture people by telling them you need to get up at 4 a.m. and take cold showers. And that's going to benefit you. Right. Yes. This is a sadist. I think a sadist would have a good avenue in this grifting, like this biohacking grifting, because it just seems unbelievable what's being recommended. And what the outcome is just kind of a slight tweak. We're not talking about clinical disorders. Going back to like the testosterone thing, no one is saying that even abstaining from testosterone is taking you from hypogonadism, right, to clinically low testosterone to testosterone within normal range. If anything, there's just minor fluctuations, all of which are normal anyways. And so This isn't even being used to actually treat things that are clinically pathological. It's just that they want to optimize themselves in terms of, everybody wants to become a robot, like that one billionaire who's like essentially a vampire taking in like young blood or something to try to, yeah. I don't know what his name is, but I see him occasionally online be like, what are you doing? Like, what is this? What are you trying to optimize here? Like, how much better is your life given the amount of effort that this takes?
Right. I know. I've seen those videos as well. Now, we could do a deep dive into what's happening in the online world with all of this. But another big health concern surrounding self-pleasure is that high levels of masturbation constitute a so-called addiction. And there is a huge industry that's emerged around that, trying to sell people on cures to get them off of masturbation. So is there any science behind that one? Can someone actually become addicted to masturbation? And do these 12-step masturbatory addiction recovery programs actually work as promised?
So people can absolutely think that they are addicted to masturbating. And that's the key word, think. And when you're dealing with like psychological processes, how you feel about yourself, kind of really all that matters. I mean, there's not going to be a blood test to tell you that, oh yeah, you're addicted to like jerking off or not. So it relies on self-report. And so if you feel like you're addicted, that's going to be distressing for you. And so there is a lot of research, a lot of new research that's been coming out over the past 10 years. It's been great, kind of all operating under the theory of moral incongruence, which essentially is when your values do not align with your behaviors, but you're engaging in those behaviors and therefore it causes distress because you're not living up to your own values. And so that definitely plays out in the porn world. And even removing porn can play out just with masturbation alone, that if you think masturbation is unhealthy, it's immoral, it goes against your values, it's sinful and some way, but you masturbate anyways. Of course, yeah, it makes sense that you're going to feel bad about yourself afterwards. You're going to feel guilty, ashamed, embarrassed. If it's something that you told yourself you're never going to do, but you did it anyways, that's going to feel like you're out of control, right? Even if you just did it once in a year, that's going to feel like you're addicted to it because you did something that you didn't want to do. So sex addiction is more about that, the perception of feeling out of control, as opposed to any kind of concrete, universally agreed upon criteria of, especially frequency of like, oh, if you masturbate more than 3 times a day, you're an addict. There's a lot of junk and like pseudoscience out there that you may come across of like, take this quiz to see if you're a sex addict. And they'll focus more on the behaviors of like how often you're doing this or what specific behaviors. And a lot of times it is over pathologizing high frequency. It's over pathologizing open relationships, over pathologizing homosexuality, over pathologizing BDSM. Sex work, all these things that deviate from what they think is healthy sexual expression. So you see that a lot where it's easy to label oneself a sex addict because you're not essentially living the sex life that the Pope wants you to live. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of the nuanced answer to what sex addiction actually is. How is it treated? Definitely, there are a lot of residential treatment facilities. They treat it similar to like a substance use disorder, where you're away for 28 days, 45 days in like these resort facilities, getting like around the clock group therapy, different types of exercises, art therapy, you know, whatever. And there's also like 12-step programs too, like SAA and SA. Unfortunately, there is no real good data saying that that's effective. No data to suggest that the 12 steps are effective in curbing sexual behaviors that one labels for themselves as addictive or problematic. And definitely no data to support, at least empirical data, that these residential treatment facilities, the ones that you have to pay like upwards of like 60,000-70,000 grand for a month's stay. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So you're dropping a lot of money with the hopes of curing yourself of this problem, but there's no data to support that it actually does that. And then you kind of get into the ethics, you know, from the field perspective, the mental health field perspective of like, well, how ethical is it to charge somebody 70 grand when there's no evidence to support that what you're doing is actually helpful in any way whatsoever?
Right. Yeah. Now, a major issue with the folks who are pushing this idea of masturbation or sex or porn as addictive is that there seems to be a lack of acknowledgement that seemingly excessive or compulsive masturbation can be related to a number of underlying factors. You know, it might be related to a manic episode or an underlying anxiety disorder. And then there's the fact that, as you alluded to, no one can agree on how much constitutes too much when it comes to sex or porn or masturbation. And then there are all these shitty assessment tools out there, some of which can diagnose you as a sex addict simply on the basis of you perceiving your own behaviors as not normal and keeping your sexual behaviors private, which are such laughably low bars that could lead almost anybody to be diagnosed as an addict. So can you just speak a little bit more to how it's impossible to come up with some kind of objective standard that says, if you're having this many orgasms per week, or if you're having this much sex, that you're addicted to it?
Yeah, it's all relative. And I think I don't like the analogy of sexual behavior with substance use, but there is some decent overlap and it's some like shared language. So even within like clinical circles, we can talk about, well, what's the diagnostic criteria for a substance use disorder? And can that be applied in some way to like sexual behavior? Because now with like DSM-5, that's applied to gambling. Pathological gambling is now within like the addictive like substance use disorder section and pretty much has the same diagnostic criteria gambling does as cocaine dependence. So some of those criteria, even from like a DSM clinical psych perspective, wouldn't quantify the amount somebody is masturbating as a metric. Even though early drafts of like a hypersexual disorder that tried to get into the DSM-5, which ultimately was rejected, that did try to quantify it to 7 times a week on average. And like, that's once a day. I think you're going to capture a lot of people as sex addicts as being quote unquote hypersexual if that's going to be one of the criteria. Obviously, there's going to be other criteria with that, but just for frequency, that's a little concerning that, in my opinion, like that was a very low bar. Because I think a lot of people engage in sexual behavior on a daily basis, like they masturbate once a day or they have sex, you know, once a day or whatever, and it's not a problem in their life at all. And so quantifying it in some way, I think, is a huge issue that we shouldn't even look at. And we should look more at how is it impacting your life. Now, how can it impact one's life is that it can be detrimental to one's life. If you masturbate and you masturbate to porn and you're in a relationship, that is considered cheating. And your spouse finds your browser history of like big titty goth girlfriends or something that you forgot to delete. Yeah, you're going to have a relationship problem. It is going to fuck up your life, possibly lead to a divorce. Does that mean that masturbating to goth women on the internet is inherently unhealthy? No, but it's unhealthy for that person. It's unhealthy for that person in that relationship. So all these contextual things are important. And it's important to also think then to back out and see the big picture of like, well, this really isn't a masturbation problem. This is a couple's problem. Right. Or this is a religious problem because you're feeling bad about yourself and you're thinking it's ruining your life because it goes against your religious values. It's like, well, this other person over here is doing the exact same thing you are, has different values, and has no problem in their life. So to me, that suggests it's more of an individual issue and something else other than the sexual behavior that we need to be concerned about. And that's important for me to say as a clinical psychologist, because I don't want to be too flippant talking about this issue, because people are really distressed and are struggling and are having impacts in their life surrounding their masturbation. But it's not the masturbation per se. That's the problem, right? And it's not like I would be turning them away at the door, be like, no, you don't have a masturbation issue. Masturbation addiction is a complete made up thing. You're fine. It's like, no, they're not fine, but let's really get at the root issue here. And it's not just the masturbating. It's how they view masturbation and how others in their life view it.
Yeah. It's usually never just the masturbation.
So right, yeah.
A lot of what we've been talking about today focuses on beliefs about how masturbation is bad for men, how it hurts their health, how it takes away all of your testosterone and life force, how it's addictive, etc. And most of the treatments and community groups are directed toward men. Mm-hmm. But what about women? Are there people out there promoting the idea that masturbation is also bad for women's health and that they should be abstaining from it too?
Yeah, absolutely. And my goal for this book at the onset of writing it was to keep it completely gender neutral, because I thought, like, I don't even really need to insert gender into this. I'm talking about genitals. I'm talking about sexual behavior. So I don't really need to say men versus women, things like that. But that became completely impossible once I started looking at the history of anti-masturbation attitudes and how they're very, very much gendered. And even a lot of the science and research on masturbation, just based on the participants and how the report or the results are talked about, are very gendered. So that was impossible for me to ignore. And yeah, it is heavier on the male side. And I think my editor did a nice job of trying to strike a little bit of a balance. And she was always like, well, what about women for this? It's like, there's just nothing written on this particular topic. But there is. In some of the sections, one being the role of vibrator use and concerns that it's desensitizing the clitoris and to the point where the person is not going to be responsive to sexual behavior without using a vibrator. Now, what's interesting with that common concern that I see amongst my students, I saw it when I was practicing psychology, I saw it amongst my patients of like being very concerned about the what kind of quote unquote damage to their body would result from vibrator use. It doesn't do any damage to your body, so you should know that. There's a misuse of the term desensitize, for sure. It's not desensitizing anything like on a neurological level. You can become accustomed to a particular sensation that feels the best for you. You found a mechanism that leads to orgasm in the most effective, pleasurable, and efficient way. That should be celebrated. That shouldn't be looked upon as a negative in any way. But I think because we view masturbation as less than partnered behavior, that's why we look at it as a problem. Because, oh, now I can't respond in the same way with my husband, right? Or whoever my partner may be, that I'm now addicted to or dependent on a vibrator. It's like, no, you're not. You found how your body responds the best. That's great. You know, 100% nothing wrong with you whatsoever. And kudos to you for finding a mechanism to experience that level of sexual satisfaction that consistently. If this is a clinical issue, then it's finding ways to incorporate what you learn about yourself and masturbation into partnered sex. And that may be including the use of a vibrator. And where the times you get resistance to that is viewing partnered sex as having to be a certain thing that isn't dependent on or even utilizing at all any kind of outside sexual aids like sex toys or vibrators. The expectation that penile-vaginal intercourse should be enough on its own to produce the same type of pleasure that I experience alone with a vibrator. And so counseling and therapy then would kind of focus on adjusting those expectations and challenging those assumptions. So that's one thing I see with women in particular. Other times too, that they fit into these issues just into a lesser degree. And that's its own level of misogyny and sexism in and of itself, because the assumption that, oh, this isn't important to women. Women aren't masturbating as much as men, or it's just not as valued as much in their life, or they could take it or leave it. Whereas with men, they have to do it, right? And so some of these sexist beliefs about sexual behavior that aren't unique to masturbation, they apply to other types of sexuality and sexual behaviors as well. But that certainly plays out. And I even kind of questioned some of these semen retention people who are so focused on ejaculation. I was like, well, is it actually ejaculation that you think is so detrimental or just orgasm? And how do you think women who aren't ejaculating but having orgasm, what do you think that's having an impact on their body? And they kind of stumbled a bit and they say like, oh, it's still having an impact on them, but just less so because they have less muscle mass. And I was like, all right, okay. That doesn't make any sense, but okay. Nope. So they still think it's a concern and a problem for women, but less though, and probably because some of those sexist beliefs as thinking that it's just not valuable for them or not important.
Yeah. So I have one last question for you.
Yep.
In your book, you talk about how anti-masturbation folks often misrepresent the facts, but pro-masturbation folks sometimes do so in the sense that they seemingly sell masturbation as a cure-all for everything, suggesting that if we all masturbated more, the world would be a better place for everyone. We might even have world peace. So can you speak to that point a little more and how, as usual, the truth is usually somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, I ended the book with this of kind of looking at this neoliberal concept of masturbation being self-care. And I had this whole section, it was a little bit of a tirade of kind of being very critical of neoliberal ideas of self-care, of kind of it's on us, we have to lift ourselves up by our own bootstraps to be healthy. If it's we have depression, anxiety, high cholesterol, we have the tools within ourselves to fix that, right? And it doesn't matter that we're working a soul-crushing 60-hour work week that's barely paying the bills. feels we're depressed and anxious because we're not doing something enough, right? So that's the general criticisms of neoliberalism approaches to self-care, that we're ignoring kind of collective action to address the root causes of some of our distress. And masturbation certainly falls into that, how I've seen it talked about more recently. And I try not to be too cynical with it. I can have a tendency to like piss on parades. That's not the expression. It's raining on parades. I think I made it. No, piss on parades is the same thing. It's going to ruin the parade. Piss on parades,
that's a kink. That's different.
Yeah. It may ruin the parade for some, not others. Yeah, I didn't want to, because my editor came back, the first draft of that conclusion was like, let's lighten this up a bit. This is the end. Let's end on a high note. But yeah, of how masturbation is talked about within self-care as kind of being the savior. Right. I spent the whole book challenging the notion that masturbation is this destroyer of bodies, souls, and civilizations. But oftentimes I see it, the kind of the pendulum swings completely in the opposite direction of like, oh, we need to masturbate to save ourselves. And here's all the benefits that we can gather and get and reap from masturbating. And some of those are truthful, right? And some of that is backed up by science. Others, I don't know where they're getting that masturbation will clear your skin or things like that. So I think it is a misunderstanding or a misrepresentation of the research. But I think for me, what I wanted to really land on in the end is that, yeah, there are some non-sexual benefits to masturbating. The physiological process of orgasm, it can allow us to be more at ease, to relax us a bit, can help us fall asleep. And people self-report that these are motivations to masturbate. But what's often overlooked is the number one reason people say that they masturbate, and that's simply to feel good, to feel pleasure. And I think that's all the justification masturbation needs. And I think that's some of my critique, is that we're trying to do some respectability politics with masturbation to try to sell it to the public. It was like, oh no, this isn't just a sexual behavior. This is what you can put on your to-do list to engage in wellness and self-care, that look at all these health benefits that it has. It's like, yeah, okay, some of that is based a little bit in reality and in science. But even if that wasn't the case, masturbation by itself should be valued, and we should view it as a legitimate form of sexual expression simply because it's a moment of pleasure. And that's all the justification we need for it.
Yeah, very well said. And what we should not be hearing is somebody telling us that all of the problems in our life are caused by us masturbating. Mm-hmm. Or all of the problems in our life are caused by us not masturbating.
Right, yes. Yeah,
because
right.
When it's one of those two extremes, it's not quite the right message. So yes, yeah. Masturbate mm-hmm. just because it feels good.
It feels good. That's all the motivation you need.
I love that. So thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Eric. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work and get a copy of your new book titled DIY?
Yeah, sure. I'm on social media. I'm on, Instagram, Threads, and Twitter, all at Dr. Sprankle. My website, drsprankle.com. You'll see all the links to get the book DIY. Two links typically. One's just to the Amazon one. If you don't want to shop at Amazon, it's another independent booksellers too. Just search for it there. And then also I have a link to Next Chapter Booksellers here in St. Paul in Minnesota. They're the exclusive provider for signed copies that they can ship out anywhere in the U.S. So if you want a signed copy, go to the Next Chapter Booksellers, their site. Otherwise, wherever you buy books, it'll be there.
Great. And I'll be sure to include links to your website and social media handles in the show notes. Thanks again so much for your time. I really appreciate having you here.
Thanks, Justin.
Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lehmiller and Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.